Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge, and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital. And I'm joined by Lyndon Robertson, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. Always good to see you. And hello to all those of you that are joining us. Glad to have you with us.
Lyndon and I have both been working on the concept of social capital for a long time, with Lyndon initially approaching it from economics, whereas I came to the concept from sociology and social theory. We're both extremely passionate about the concept, and our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting conversations and engaging debates. In this episode, we will discuss the relationship between social capital and behavioral economics. Since the early days of social capital theorizing, it has been used in an attempt to resolve the frequent and important conflicts between neoclassical economic theory and observed behavior. Such conflicts have been described as economic agents misbehaving or making predictably irrational choices, perhaps. And in behavioral economics, this is often described as perhaps nudges that could change economic behavior without offering traditional economic incentives. So, Lyndon, how has social capital theory changed you as an economist?
Well, thank you, Tristan. Great introduction and a great question. And I think on our very first show together, you asked me something very similar. And about how I came to be interested in social capital, which wasn't a concept at the time. That was in the mid 80s. And for me, there were behavior that I engaged in and that I recognized in others that didn't fit the selfishness of preference paradigm, the rational choice theory that is the hallmark of much of neoclassical economics. And it led me to think, what is missing? And one analogy is that if you observe people buying airplane tickets or airline tickets, and you ignore those occasions when they use accumulated miles, and you only observe the money transactions, you'll get a much different view of the shopping behavior and the buying behavior of people buying airlines. And for me, social capital has been something like that. It's the it's sort of the missing ingredient that, if you ignore, makes behavior that is often observed appear to be irrational. And so I find myself often relying on social capital theory to explain transactions and interactions that I think are beyond the scope of neoclassical economics in many ways. And I think behavioral economics was motivated by something very similar.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that social capital perhaps has a home in behavioral economics. I looked up, I'm not an economist, so I'm very interested in economic thought, of course. So I looked up the definition of what behavioral economics is, and reading from Wikipedia, it says that behavioral economics is the study of psychological, cognitive, emotional, cultural, and social factors involved in the decisions of individuals or institutions, and how these decisions deviate from those implied by classical economic theory. So this seems to be exactly what we're talking about with social capital. So I guess the question then is, are you a behavioral economist? Or we don't typically see social capital as a concept being used extensively in behavioral economics. So what do you think is going on here? Like, what's the relationship between social capital, behavioral economics? Where does it all fit together?
Well, so people like Richard Thaler and Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, all really sort of important figures in the development of behavioral economics. And the focus was, and this may be overgeneralizing, was identifying behaviors that were inconsistent with what Richard Thaler called econs, people who were selfish, fully informed, you know, self-controlled, not influenced by relationships, and the hallmark of sort of the textbook in economics. And so behavior that was inconsistent with those was something that behavioral economists could point out. And often those were explained by behavioral biases, cognitive biases, tendencies towards one thing or another. And there's now a long list of cognitive biases, and we have been content to say, well, that's just our nature. So here's an easy example. People buying ice cream prefer ice cream that's labeled 90% fat-free compared to ice cream labeled 10% fat. And medical remedies that emphasize the lives saved versus the lives lost. So we know that that appealing to what have been labeled cognitive biases does change behavior. I mean, there's nothing different between ice cream that's 10% fat versus 90% fat free, but it does affect us. Our decisions are different, and we appeal to our social emotional natures to say, well, there's something going on besides simply trying to buy commodities.
If we look all the way back to Jim Coleman's work on social capital, which he did primarily in the 1980s, he adopted, rational choice, what he called rational choice sociology, which was, I guess, the same thing. It was looking to extend rational choice theory from neoclassical economics by adding in those sociological factors that perhaps were missing, that couldn't predict human behavior particularly well. And so behavioral economics seems to be the same kind of idea, where it's still taking the fundamental principles of economic thinking, but then it's adjusting them, starting from that point and then adding in those things that are missing. And it's interesting, the Wikipedia entry, the list of factors that are included, I'm sure they're accurate, but they're psychological, cognitive, emotional, cultural, and social factors. They're the factors that are listed, and I'm sure they are the ones that behavioral economists are interested in. But it seems like the first one, or perhaps the first two, psychological and cognitive, are the ones that are focused on the most. And so it continues to take that individualistic perspective about human behavior in the ways in which they're thinking about what people do. Do you think that's accurate? You might have read more behavioral economics literature than I have, perhaps.
So I think if I were to present a subtitle for social capital theory, it would be social capital theory, or the social capital paradigm, : relationships matter, and they matter a lot. And which is exactly the opposite of what an econ would assume. And my own experience is that I am every minute of every day influenced by a relationship, exactly, and an exchange of something. So I was watching my granddaughter and my daughter at a tennis match, and they were communicating something, and it was not coaching, but it was an emotional exchange that changed behavior. So my view of social capital is that relationships matter, and relationships matter because we exchange something And I've referred to this as relational goods that satisfy social emotional needs. The original term had a different meaning, but for my purposes, I think of relationships, people in relationships exchanging relational goods, and these are goods because they satisfy needs. And what I find missing in behavioral economics is sort of the explanation of what is it that goes on between relationships that matters so much. And what if we ignore and we don't add it, it leaves us saying we have predictably irrational behavior or people misbehaving. And I think our goal, and we've discussed this, is to try and maybe present a more complete paradigm by adding in relational goods, social emotional needs, attachment values, institution, other things that allow us to explain predictably irrational behavior. And once you include these other goods and needs, behavior, which before was irrational, seems quite rational. And I'll take one popular example that in the literature, people showing up late to daycare center. And the economic solution was to increase the to impose a fine for showing up late. And the response was, after you did it, late pickups increased. And the explanation from a social capital point of view is that you removed the relational badge from showing up late. I mean, if I can pay for it, I don't have to feel guilty. Well, that's kind of an example of where I think we can make progress beyond what is available, at least what I'm familiar with in behavioral economics, going beyond simply recognizing cognitive biases and other kinds of bias. I think there are useful explanations.
Yeah, perhaps we should clarify what we mean by relationships, because from my understanding, it is the personal relationships we have but it's also the ways in which we're connected, the relationship we have with our wider family, who we may or may not know, have personal relationships with, our wider organization, our wider society. It's the ways in which we're connected through our social groupings that of course, the fundamental part of that is the personal social relationships that we have, the people that we know, but it's more than that, because it is the way in which we're connected. Is that the way that you would understand relationships when we talk about relationships in the context of social capital?
Yes, I think very much so. If by relationship I understand it's how we're connected, and we can be connected directly with another person. We can be connected through a friend indirectly. We can become connected by commitments to causes and organizations and places and so on. So there's lots of ways that we can be connected. And so we have to recognize the many different ways that we can exchange what I'm calling here relational goods. We receive a recommendation from another person. We find ourselves supporting similar causes. All of these connections, these commonalities that we've referred to in the past, are means for exchanging relational goods. That leads us to explain behavior that otherwise would appear irrational or misbehaving, something along that line.
Yeah, and I think from a social theory point of view, the idea that economic agents misbehave or are irrational doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because all you have to do to understand those behaviors that are supposedly misbehaving or irrational is just simply to understand their life circumstance, like the way they understand the world around them, and they're no longer misbehave, they're no longer irrational. they're perfectly rational and they're perfectly logical and they're in line with the way in which they understand the world. You know, if they're making decisions based on the nature of their social relationships and the way they're connected within society, there's nothing irrational about that at all. This is perfectly logical. There's reasons for doing the things that they do, but those reasons are based on those connections, the relational goods that they exchange and the internal or external validation that they might receive. You know, these are the reasons, so they're not irrational. And I think that's what the concept of social capital is aiming to achieve. But having said that, of course, social capital in the way in which it's been theorized over the last 30 or 40 years typically doesn't quite get there. You know, it's kind of starting from neoclassical economic theorizing about human experience and behavior, and then trying to add in those things that are missing, but it doesn't ever really quite seem to get to the real reasons why people do the things that they do. And I think that's where the biggest amount of work still needs to be done on social capital is to bring a rich and solid theoretical foundation to the reasons why people do what they do.
I think I couldn't agree more. And I think to the extent that we're willing to agree to some fundamental principles on which we base our social capital theory or social capital paradigm, and you're in the middle of discussing pillars of social capital, which I think is very helpful. To the extent that we can come together and generally agree that social capital has properties of capital, that it has to produce something that involves exchanges, you know, if we can sort of agree and sort of put forth a logically reasoned approach to studying social behavior, I think social capital as a theory will improve its standing, which is, I think, right now, if you ask someone what is social capital, you would get a lot of different answers, and surely they wouldn't agree. And it leaves some people saying, I don't know what to do with social capital theory. You can't define it, you don't agree on what it does. And so I think, to that extent, our progress has not been as significant as it could be if we could move closer to some kind of consensus about what does social capital bring to behavioral economics? What does it bring to sociology and anthropology? What does it have to contribute?
And what do all of those disciplines also have to contribute to social capital as well? I think, you know, these are
Exactly.
interesting conversations because I think out of everything that I've done in the last few years, what has been most helpful for me was to take the lists of factors that you often find in the social capital theories. You know, it's norms and it's belonging and it's trust and it's solidarity and it's, you know, like you get these lists. And I've often been curious, well, what do all of these things have in common? You know, is this an exhaustive list? Are there others on this list that we haven't included? And I think they're not exhaustive lists because people will always keep coming up with other things to add to these lists, and it gets bigger and bigger and more unwieldy and more complicated and challenging to understand. And so what I explored was, well, what do all of these things in this list have in common? You know, what is the superordinate of all of these things? And that process was very useful because what all of those things I described, belonging and trust and norms and solidarity, what they all have in common is they reflect our predispositions or they reflect our inclinations towards others, you know, how we understand what we should and shouldn't do in relation to others. And when we understand that that's the superordinate, then we can understand how each of those different factors influence our predispositions in slightly different but similar ways, and we can then identify other ways in which our predispositions are influenced. And that seems to be what's largely been missing from the social capital theorizing over the last 40 years is digging deeper than just simply what these lists. And I think if there's one thing we could change in the social capital theories that exist is to move away from lists. Lists are great examples, but what is the real underlying theory that is guiding these lists of different factors that are being included?
That's insightful, very much so, Tristan. And I think for me, these predispositions, our attitudes and experiences and so on, to me, they lead to sort of this point. To what extent does another person's well-being matter to me? Is what happens to each of us independent? I don't care, it doesn't affect me. Or are we connected? Is our well-being connected? And I have used words like sympathy and empathy and to describe the degree of interdependence. And there may be better words. There may be a better way to describe our connection reflected by social capital theory. But if our well-being is interdependent and what happens to you happens to me or matters to me, then the way we allocate resources and decide questions and invest in public and private goods is profoundly affected, and opens up just wide areas for exploration and explanation of how we can get better outcomes. You used the word nudges, and of course there's a book on that topic of how we can change behavior by recognizing these. But at the heart of it is, if there's no interdependence in our how we perceive each other's well-being, to how effective can we be in changing can we appeal to biases and cognitive predispositions to produce outcomes, or can we be more effective if we simply recognize that this is the basis for sort of pro-social behavior and lots of things that we would like to achieve? And how do we get more of it if it's a good thing? And those are the kinds of questions that I think we should be asking.
Yeah, because we all agree that social capital is about relationships. And as we discussed, relationships really is about the ways in which we're connected. And fundamentally, the ways in which we're connected is those ways that do connect our well-being, that do relate to our concern and interest in others and our position relative to others. That's what relationships are all about. And it seems to be what's been overlooked in much of the social capital theory, except very notably, as I've said before, except for yours, and maybe a few others as well. The literature is extremely diverse and extensive. But we tend to, in social capital theories, the dominant view is that a relationship exists, but we don't seem to dig into the reasons why and what that means and how that really does influence the nature of our actions beyond the lists that we talked about, well, norms and trust and solidarity and identity and so forth, without really exploring, well, how does that connect us and how does that influence our behavior at that deeper level? And empathy, sympathy, internalizing others' well-being, like that has to lie at the heart of what connects us.
Maybe there's a positive side from these various definitions of social capital that we should take comfort from, because they all point us to a relationship. They, you know, maybe it's a step away, but these lists often point to the importance of relationships. So maybe we're not as far away as we might say.
Well, and that's right. And I think, like, bringing it back to our topic for this episode, you know, connection with behavioral economics, is that social capital is fundamentally working on the same kind of has the same kind of goals that behavioral economics does, which is to correct for or to bring in those To use the list again from Wikipedia, psychological, cognitive, emotional, cultural, social factors in human action. Like, to me, that's exactly what social capital has been attempting to achieve for the last 40 years, and there's a lot of parallels there with what behavioral economics is doing.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I guess we keep going.
Yeah, I think so. So we've kind of run out of time for this episode. I think, this is an important conversation to have about what we're trying to achieve in social capital, because I think it does help to guide where the definition and the meaning and the theory goes and where we put our efforts. So thanks, Lyndon, for your time today. Looking forward to the next episode.
Thank you, Tristan, and thank you all for joining us today. Look forward to our next episode.
So do I.